wrong. Discussing that order can be an effective conversation as well. Jackie Robinson once said that a life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. You can use the same criterion for deciding which events belong in a summary. An event is most important in the impact it has, or is likely to have, on other scenes in the story. If you know or think it will affect the outcome of the book, include it in the summary. If not, drop it. Better connections. When asking students to make connections beyond a text, champion teachers recognize that certain types of questions are usually more rigorous and more likely to reinforce reading comprehension than others. The types of questions are listed next in priority order according to their relative rigor, with the more rigorous question formats at the top. Be aware that this order may be contrary to what many teachers expect or assume. Text to text. These are preferable to text to world and text to self because they reinforce testable ideas rather than judgments, opinions, and stories that students may not be able to access. That happened once to my mom. They can include within the text questions, when else in the book have we seen someone act this way? And across-text questions, can you think of a character in another book we've read who was similar? Or how is the suspense in this chapter like or unlike the suspense at the end of Fantastic Mr. Fox? Text to world. Asking students to relate an issue in the story to some event or person in their world is a valid exercise. This is so especially when it asks students to connect specific aspects of a text to specific aspects of the broader world, rather than allowing them to discuss any connection they see to any event in the world. Some of the most common text-to-world connections are text-to-media connections, in which students connect something in the text with television shows or movies they have seen. Text-to-media connections can often take conversations about texts off track. It may be best to tell students that you are not looking for text-to-media connections. However, assuming a student's text-to-media connection is a valid one, the best follow-up question is something like this. How does the connection you are making between our hero in the text and Spider-Man help you to understand the text? Or, what specifically about Mr. Fox is similar to Spider-Man? Text to self. These questions are inevitable and valid, but they are also more limited in their relevance to other students and comprehension of texts. Although engaging, they can often lead classes astray. They are best when they focus on the specific elements of the text being read. How would you feel if you were in a position like Donovan Charles, rather than sweeping in their breadth? Did anyone else have a time when they felt scared? Keep in mind that connections are not an end in and of themselves. For example, while reading a story about a birthday party, a student may say, "I went to my cousin's birthday party last week." It is important not to accept this connection without further questioning. What happened at your cousin's birthday party that reminds you of this story? Or, what kinds of things happened at your cousin's birthday party that might also happen here? Students should be encouraged to use their connection to develop an understanding of the text, and to do that, you should bring the connection back to the text. So, how does that help us understand what's happening here? Teaching literary structures and conventions is especially productive in helping students make worthy connections. The basic idea is that conventions describe the ways stories usually or often work. The degree to which a story conforms to or diverges from convention, what most stories do, is a deeply productive line for connecting. But to do so, students need lots of study of other texts and the idea of structures and conventions. Point out that they can and should look for connections to text, particularly text-to-text connections and connections based on structures, conventions, and methods. Ensuring a rich collection of shared books that the whole class or school has read is one good way to enable this. Standard-aligned questions. Most state standards articulate a dozen or so core types of questions students need to be able to answer. If they don't do so explicitly, the assessment portfolio your school uses, state tests, SATs, and whatever additional assessments you add, do it implicitly. For example, New York essentially asks four types of character study questions. Character change, how did X change during the story? Character perspective. Which of these statements would X probably agree with? Character motivation. Why did X decide to walk home from school? And character traits. X could best be described as... Although it's easy for teachers to fall into the habit of asking the same three or four types of questions over and over, their students need to practice the full array of question types, both to ensure their success on assessments that stand between them and college, and college readiness, and to make sure they are comfortable demonstrating a wide range of skills. Discipline yourself to ask questions that mirror the kinds of comprehension questions students need to master, thus providing practice at all skills and enforcing diversity on you and your students. Top teachers are intentional about this in several ways, often making an inclusive list and mapping them into their unit plans so they are constantly focusing on a different type of question. They also study the different formats of questions used on assessments to better understand how the questions are asked and ensure that their own questions are at least as rigorous as the questions that control access to college. Reading strategies and the techniques of champion teachers. In the introduction to this book, I discussed the difference between techniques and strategies. I recognize in drawing this distinction that many teachers of reading use what they refer to as reading strategies to guide their teaching. These strategies draw from the work of several authors who propose similar conceptualizations of the strategies students need to achieve full comprehension. They usually include a group of skills like the following: noticing, connecting, picturing, wondering, predicting, inferencing, and summarizing. Given the prominence of strategies-based instruction in the professional discourse of reading teachers, I'll describe how the techniques here can overlap and interface with common approaches to reading strategies. Although a variety of authors write about reading strategies, I will use Nancy Boyles's book, Constructing Meaning Through Kid-Friendly Comprehension Strategy Instruction, 2004, for this discussion, because it is among the clearest and most effective. In the analysis here, I am frankly critical of some aspects of strategies instruction and the manner in which it can be employed. Therefore, I want to make it clear that I believe that well-implemented strategies-based reading instruction can be effective, and that the work of authors like Boyles has advanced the quality of the teaching of reading. At the same time, a series of significant pitfalls can erode its effectiveness, and a wide disparity exists in effectiveness among the strategies. With that in mind, I make some general observations about strategies, and then look at each of the most common strategies individually. Risks and challenges of strategies instruction. Relying heavily on reading strategies poses risks and challenges. One challenge is that the strategies involved are often too broadly defined. The strategy noticing, which Boyles defines as keying into important verbal clues, words, sentences, and paragraphs that offer evidence of the text's meaning, page 10, is an example. By that definition, what comment about a text, even one only tangentially related to it, would not be an example of noticing? And because nearly every response to a book requires an act of noticing something, teachers risk reinforcing the idea that any observation is worthwhile, or that all observations are equally productive. However, all comments can't be equally useful, so the necessary and often unresolved question quickly becomes, how can teachers identify and help students understand the things that are most worthy of notice? And how can they systematically be identified and modeled? A second challenge in strategies-based reading instruction is a confusion of correlation and cause. This is reflected in the basic argument behind strategies-based instruction, that if good readers do X, then those who do X will become good readers. Good readers may picture what they are reading in their minds as they read it, but this may well be an effect rather than a cause of good reading. Is this really a significant issue? Surely a study of proficient readers could reveal that strong readers all like to sit in comfortable chairs when they read. If this were the case, there would be a strong correlation between comfort and reading. But if we assumed a causal relationship, as strategies theory sometimes advises, we would likely approach reading by making the seating of students in more comfortable chairs a major priority, which would clearly be a mistake, and an expensive one at that. Similarly, it's a larger logical leap than it may appear to suggest that practicing picturing will make you a better reader. In fact, two examples Boyles provides suggest how tenuous this assumption is. In the first example, Boyles writes, "To help students understand the value of using the picturing strategy while reading, I ask them to remember a time when they received big news, whether it was good news or bad news. Where were you when you got the news?" I ask. "What was the weather like at the time? Who was with you?" Chances are you can answer all of these questions. The content of that message, the big news you received, is forever embedded in the context in which you received the news, a context that is made of many different sensory impressions. Page 8. Ironically, Boyles' example may prove only that students already have the capacity to picture. She assumes that if she asks them to recall an intense memory, they will have a strong visual memory of it. The problem then may not be that the students don't know how to picture. It may be that if they understand what they read and have excess processing capacity left over after figuring out the words and the basic facts of the description, they will picture it naturally. That, Boyles appears to assume, is what their minds naturally do. In that case, teaching them to read fluently and attend carefully to mundane details might be more effective than investing time in intentionally teaching them to picture, something they appear to know how to do. They just need a clear sense of what to picture. In a similar example, Boyles writes, "Readers figure out different kinds of things as they read," I tell my students, holding up the figuring out mini poster. For example, the author might write that a certain character calls people names and teases kids who are younger, and this character picks fights, too. The author wants us to figure out that this kid is a... How would you fill in that blank? I ask my students. "Bully," everyone choruses. "He's a bully." Page 12. The fact that Boyles assumes that her students already have the capacity to figure out a story before she's taught them strategies, as long as the basic narrative is presented to them as simple, clear formulation, suggests that the problem may not be in their capacity to figure out, but in their capacity to understand enough of the details of the story to engage their figuring out skills fully. In short, good readers may figure out, but the problem for bad readers may not be that they don't know how to figure out, but rather that they don't understand what they've read enough to use those skills. Another challenge to strategies instruction, a challenge to which the techniques in this book are not immune, is that the easier a strategy is to understand and use, the more likely teachers may be to use it. However, something easier to use is not necessarily more conducive to student achievement. Connecting, picturing, and predicting are especially tangible and specific. Their clarity may tacitly encourage teachers to use them more often. This may not be justified, however, because they have significant downsides, which are discussed later in this section, particularly in regards to picturing, a technique easily overused and therefore particularly distracting. In addition, reading strategies can be used to promote both engagement and comprehension, which are different goals, and teachers sometimes do not recognize the difference between the two. Boyles writes, "If we try really hard to think of ways a story connects to us and our lives, we're more likely to stick with the story. That's one reason it's so important to look for connections. Making connections with the text will help us to keep reading it." Page 7. Although it's certainly worthwhile to try to engage students in texts so they want to read them, it's also important to note that making students want to read a book and ensuring that they comprehend it are different issues. Picturing what they're reading may engage students and cause them to persist in reading, but this is a different issue from whether they understand what they are reading. For all you know, the picture they've made in their minds is erroneous. Strategies-based instruction can frequently fail to make this distinction. Finally, there is a large caveat regarding fluency that generally does not get fully acknowledged in discussions of strategies instruction. Boyles writes, "Teaching reading comprehension strategies can benefit just about any student operating at a reasonable level of reading fluency, second grade or above." Page Roman 14. It's worth noting that many students in high poverty schools aren't at that level, and Boyles' assertion that a second grade level of fluency is the cutoff point for determining the efficacy of strategies instruction appears to be arbitrary. What if it's fifth grade, What if it's sufficient to the level of the book you're trying to read, and the book is hard? With any technique, the question we should ask is not whether its use can help students learn to read, but whether it can help students learn to read better and more efficiently than reading. Whether this is the case with strategies instruction remains an unanswered question. It is almost assuredly the case in some instances and assuredly not the case in others. The unintended consequence of any teaching approach is the tendency to make the approach, not comprehension, the purpose. For example, a student makes a useful comment, but the teacher says, "You're not visualizing. I asked you to visualize." This risk is especially acute in strategies-based instruction because the strategies are actions students are supposed to enact. And this public aspect means there's an incentive to misapply the approach more aggressively and broadly. This is especially true with techniques in this book. Ben Markowitz, principal of the successful Psi Academy Charter School in New Orleans, described how to think about this paradox in a panel presentation. "My teachers are accountable for results. The techniques can get them there. They have for others. But the point is to succeed, not to use the techniques no matter what. If they can find some other way to get great results, I don't have a problem with that." Specific strategies and their relationship to the techniques in this book. In this section, I discuss each of several common reading strategies and analyze both areas of concern and their connection to the techniques described in this book. Noticing. In further describing the strategy of noticing, Boyles writes, "When we find clues in the text, we should file them away carefully in our mind so we can pull them out later and see how they all fit together as main ideas and themes." Page 11. While noticing things is critical to becoming an effective reader, it is far too broadly and vaguely defined to be useful as a tool for teaching. What comment, observation, or moment of engaged attention would not be an example of noticing something about a text? Since every response to a book requires an act of noticing something, teachers risk reinforcing that any observation is worthwhile, or that all observations are equally productive. Or they risk telling students to notice without giving them useful guidance on what to notice. The question is, what are the things students should notice most, and how can they systematically be identified and modeled? One place where the techniques I've described in this section can be especially useful is in helping students to notice better. What kind of observations can students make to use their noticing in the most productive way? Observations that relate to and advance understanding of the most important ideas in what you are reading. This sounds obvious, but can be greatly improved with a bit of discipline and advanced planning. Use focal points, for example, to draw students' attention to some critical themes or ideas in what you're reading, and ask them to try to notice as they are reading the things that make Macbeth's ambition destroy him, or that allow Charlotte's goodness to change and Wilbur to mature. In short, don't just have students read. Have them read for something. Alternatively, and especially if you prefer a style that's less prescriptive about what the most important things might be, use front-loading to draw students' attention to scenes of special importance so that you can discuss critical watershed moments in special depth. Observations that relate to and advance understanding of skills, that is, learning standards, you're teaching at the time. Using standards-aligned questioning is especially effective to develop students' skills at noticing a wide variety of powerful things about a text. If you are studying characterization, for example, ask them to notice how the characters are changing, or are described, or speak. Many students are most inclined to notice in the ways that are most natural and intuitive for them. Asking them to employ specific skills in noticing forces them out of their comfort zones and builds their ability to notice in a wider variety of ways. Evidence-based observations. Noticing the evidence that supports the opinion is as important as the opinion itself, or even more important. What makes you mistrust him is usually a better question than, do you trust the main character? Use evidence-based questioning to stress this aspect of noticing. Observations drawing on different levels of noticing. The thing about not noticing is secondary ignorance. By its definition, you don't usually know that you didn't notice something. A lower-level technique can cause students to notice more systematically by stressing and causing them to practice different types of things to notice about a text. Observing what a tricky phrase means or how an author cleverly crafted a sentence to make the subject of the action unclear is often just as important as noticing that the main character is probably untrustworthy. Certainly, students need to practice noticing at all of these levels. Ask them, then try to notice things about the colloquial phrases an author uses, her word choice, or how she likes to start or finish her chapters, or ideally how her word choice and use of phrases show that she's trying to do something particular with the beginning of chapters. Connecting. When connecting, or making connections, students are socialized to think of ways the text they are reading is similar to some previous or familiar experience. Readers can connect with another text, a text-to-text connection, the world, a text-to-world connection, or themselves, a text-to-self connection. One of the benefits Boyles describes of connecting is that it engages students in the text. If we try really hard to think of ways a story connects to us and our lives, we're more likely to stick with the story, page 7. This is certainly true and significant, though it's also worth observing that while getting students to engage is an important and worthy goal, it is a different goal from their comprehending. Thoughtful connections can often be the jumping-off place for inferences about the text. They can help students begin to understand the text by tapping into what they already know about a topic. Effective connections can also help students see the story from a character's point of view by accessing their own analogous experience. But they don't necessarily do this, and in many cases, the connections students are most likely to make, "Hey, this is just like something that happened to my family," are least rigorous and least useful to engendering long-term reading comprehension. "Hey, this is just like the introduction to the other book we read," is probably a more useful connection in the long term than is a text-to-self connection. Furthermore, students, or teachers, can infer that the point is simply to make any kind of connection to the text. That shouldn't be the end. Connections aren't inherently valuable, only good connections are. A good connection serves to help readers understand something about the text, not the thing connected to. In most cases, having the discipline to use the world to understand the text, rather than the text to understand the world. Students can also potentially let their connection project onto the text. That is, they can replace actual details with imagined details or contradictory or confusing details, as when a student who once lost an article of clothing and was upset about it infers that a character who lost her sweater was also upset, even while the text has clues showing that the character was happy about it. Finally, connections can be off-task and waste time, and clever students can use them to co-opt discussion into easier or more convenient topics. It may also be that people naturally make connections, and so the skill doesn't need to be taught so much as managed and guided. The skill is in making connections effective and focused. In light of that, you should be clear about linking connections back to the text to understand what light the connection sheds on what you're reading. These and other aspects of making effective connections are discussed in the Better Connections section above. Picturing. In picturing, Boyles writes, students are taught to use clues from the text to create an image of what is described. This helps students remember what they've read and engage in the text. The pictures we have in our mind help us respond to the text at an emotional level, page 8, Boyles writes, and this is almost certainly true. Generally, however, picturing is among the most overused and poorly used strategies, and this is significant, because it can be among the most destructive in its application. The use of picturing as a comprehensive strategy may be confused by some teachers as validating visual literacy generally, and make it more common for them to use visual images more frequently to aid in comprehension. This may seem benign, but the result is a compensatory strategy for effective reading. In teaching students to picture, some teachers feel encouraged to draw on actual pictures to make inferences about the story in a way that crowds out reading. When a teacher says, "What do you think is about to happen? Look at the picture if you need help," she is allowing students to read the story by drawing enough information from the pictures to keep them from having to read the words to succeed. This results in their learning to circumvent their poor reading skills. Teachers may also overuse the picturing strategy because it is so accessible. As a result, they may spend valuable time visualizing rather than reading or asking more productive and rigorous questions. Teachers often make it a point to take a simple passage from a book and ask students to visualize it so they understand it. He went to his desk, opened the drawer, and pulled out a marker. "Class, let's try to visualize what that looked like. What was in the drawer? How did he walk across the room?" This can be useful, but it's also worth noting that this could be a scene where the author didn't think it was important to create a sensory image. More important, picturing can be incorrect. Students who are asked to picture an image can and often do introduce erroneous details. In this example, the student might create a false image of when and why the character went to the drawer and what he found there. Finally, it's also possible that intentionally visualizing doesn't help students learn to comprehend what they read that much. As Boyles points out in her book, people seem to naturally visualize when they understand something. So we could ask whether picturing is a strategy that causes comprehension or is the result of it, with better picturing resulting from better comprehension. The most productive applications of visualizing I've seen teachers use are to ask students to draw or picture a scene in order to clear up what's confusing about it. For example, a teacher I observed teaching Macbeth drew separate pictures of Birnam Wood and Dunsinane, and then sketched how soldiers cut down the branches and marched to the latter location, thus proving the impossible prophecy of Macbeth's dream true. This is different from asking students to share what they are visualizing. Another effective use of visualizing is to ask students to create a picture using details they have read in the book. This is actually a version of an evidence-based question, and when teachers do it well, they ask students to point out specific aspects of the story and/or where they found certain details that gave them their picture. Wondering. In wondering, students ask questions of the text as they read. Examples, Boyles writes, might include wondering what might happen next in the story or how the story might end. Page 9. This technique is also sometimes called asking questions. As with noticing, however, the technique is at times vague. Wonder about what? Anything? All things equally? Having students develop questions about what they are reading encourages them to be active readers and may motivate them to know more about a text. Moreover, wonderment and curiosity are usually very good things. The point is that there are myriad forms of wondering, and they aren't all inherently of equal value. Students' private experience, in which what they want to wonder about is their own to determine, and public experience, in which a group of people chooses certain wonderings to discuss, are different kettles of fish. There are settings for both, and in the latter, a class deserves criteria about what wonderings they'll engage most. Here are the kinds of things we're going to talk and wonder about today to increase our understanding of the story, or our skills at understanding stories. I realize this may seem either vague or directive. Is he telling us to shut down kids' imaginations? Some readers may ask. But encouraging students to wonder on the premise that it is inherently among the most valuable things they could be doing regardless of how and what they wonder about is a false premise. Wondering can be especially effective when modeled by a teacher, especially in a soliloquy form. I'm wondering here what might make Donald want to give his dog away. I'm thinking back to the earlier chapters, and I know Donald loves his dog. The author told us he would never do anything to hurt him. So I'm wondering, why might a boy give away a dog he loves? While this strategy of making thoughts visible can model how to think about books effectively, it can also result in teachers doing most of the work. Rather than involving students and working to transfer thinking skills to students, they are merely performing a public literary analysis. Predicting. Boyles writes that predicting sets the stage for students to monitor their own understanding of the text. Page 10. In its most basic and common form, it involves teachers asking students what they think is going to happen next. Its benefits include engagement. It gets students to focus on what they are reading next to see if their prediction is confirmed. When done well, it can also help them monitor their understanding of the text based on whether their predictions came true. That's the best possible outcome of predicting, but to make that effective, You should make a habit of circling back to intentionally discuss whether predictions came true and why. This last step makes predicting a relatively productive activity, but unfortunately, the last step often doesn't happen, perhaps because many teachers don't recognize the particular value of this aspect of predicting. You can augment the strength of your predicting if you use the evidence-based questioning technique. This will cause you to consistently ask more productive questions. In the immediate follow-up to each prediction, you can ask, "Why do you think that will happen next?" and "What in the text makes that seem likely to happen?" In the post-prediction follow-up, you can ask, "Why did you think so? What fooled you?" and "What made you know this would happen?" Two other challenges pose barriers to predicting and can often make it an ineffective use of time. First, students can make wild predictions unrelated to the text or more related to their lives or experiences than to the text. Alternatively, they can narrate the obvious and make predicting facile. The best defense against this is once again to focus on evidence-based questioning. This forces students to ground their predictions in the text. Figuring out and inferring. The last strategy common to most reading teachers is alternatively called figuring out or inferring. Boyles refers to figuring out as pushing students to go beyond the construction of basic meaning to a deeper understanding of the text. Page 12. This strategy attempts to focus on what is, by all rights, the heavy hitter of comprehension, understanding what's between the lines, left unsaid, hinted at. In short, this is the strategy that asks students to go beyond the basic literal understanding of the text to apply higher-order thinking. But its importance belies the difficulty of applying it. Obviously, merely asking a student to make an inference won't do. You can tell a student, "Read this page and figure something out that you can share with the class." Inference happens, but can't be commanded. To make inference successful, you must set the table, often by meticulous work with both the lower your level and don't wait techniques. When your students are learning to make inferences, you can surreptitiously assemble the key pieces they need to make their leap forward by stopping frequently with short discussions of and directives to attend to the key pieces of guidance in the pages or lines before. Stop and ask a student to reread a line, unpack a key phrase, define a word, underline a crucial piece of evidence. Focus on words and phrases. The building blocks that make or break the inference often start at the mundane level. Ironically, strong instruction on the literal meaning of the text, including vocabulary and focus on important details, doesn't distract from higher-order thinking. It makes it possible. Summarizing. Advocates of strategies-based instruction sometimes also include summarizing as a key strategy. For this strategy, I see nearly 100% overlap with the techniques in this book. For a further discussion, see 100%, Technique 36 in Chapter 6. Conclusion. The end is the beginning. In the introduction to this book, I addressed the differences between techniques and strategies. A strategy, you may recall, is a decision, and a technique is something you practice, hone, and adapt throughout your life. Artists, athletes, musicians, surgeons, and performers of a thousand other varieties achieve greatness only by their attention to the details of their technique. Their constant refinement of it perpetually renews their passion for the craft and allows them to seek the grail of better performance, expression that sings, the ability to make the greatest possible difference. This focus on technique and its constant refinement is also the path to excellence for teachers. Approaching teaching as an art, meaning by that phrase that it is difficult and requires finesse and discretion in the application, craftsmanship, and careful and attentive development of technique to master it, is the path to success. That path is different for each teacher. The techniques developed by champion teachers and described in this book were not mine to start with, but they can belong to any teacher who embraces the concept of constant attentive refinement of techniques. Only that approach, coupled with the aggregated wisdom of the teachers compiled in this book, will be sufficient to change the equation of opportunity in our schools and close the achievement gap at scale. Adapted, refined, improved, and perhaps in a few cases ignored, because not everything in this book can be right for you, these techniques can transform your classroom. A colleague of mine, Ben Markovitz, recently founded a new school in New Orleans. SCI, S-C-I, Academy, achieved exemplary first-year results with high school students who had not previously been successful. This school has made extensive and focused use of the techniques in this book, with dozens of staff meetings and training sessions. Yet when Ben was recently asked how he ensures that his teachers use this material, he observed that he doesn't. He manages his teachers for results and provides these techniques to get them there. They are free to use them or not. All of them do, with an energy and vigor I am humbled by. But Ben insists that the tools here are a means to results, not an end in themselves. I wholeheartedly agree with Ben. In fact, I would like this fact to distinguish this book from so many others. It starts with and is justified by the results it helps teachers achieve, not by its fealty to some ideological principle. The result to aim for is not the loyal adaptation of these techniques for their own sake, but their application in the service of increased student achievement. Too many ideas, even good ones, go bad when they become an end and not a means. The techniques I've written about were derived from observing outstanding teachers at work. But more exciting than that fact is the way this book has changed over the years as I have been writing it. During that time, it has evolved from an informal document within Uncommon Schools to a more explicit guide to instruction that I have shared with colleagues and offered trainings on, to this book you've now read. It has changed and evolved and gained the depth that I hope has made it worthy of your time. What gives this book its depth and focus is the unrelenting application of the ideas by remarkable teachers. What I first wrote was a skeleton of what now appears. The techniques that appeared in it were described in insufficient terms and short aspirational paragraphs. Only when other teachers tried them, applied them, adapted them, and improved them, and let me videotape them doing it, did the truly useful parts of this book emerge. In short, what's good here is good only because of the process of constantly refining and adapting techniques in the relentless and restless drive for excellence. That observation seems a fitting one with which to end. Appendix: Behind-the-Scenes Interviews. Many of the teachers and school leaders I've worked with in sharing the material in this book have asked for more information, particularly in response to the incredibly powerful videos, which show champion teachers in action. It instantly became clear that answers to many of the excellent questions teachers asked about the videos could only be provided by the teachers themselves. In response, my colleague Max Tuford, who analyzes video and develops training activities for Uncommon Schools, began interviewing many of the top teachers we'd videotaped, asking them to explain in their own words what they were doing in their videos, why they were doing it, and how they thought about and prepared to do the things they did. The resulting feedback was overwhelming. People loved the interviews. Not surprisingly, it turns out, champion teachers are far more articulate than I could be in describing their work. With that in mind, what follows are the transcripts of four of Max's interviews. Interview with Jason Armstrong. Interviewer: Discuss how the concept of right is right works in your classroom. Armstrong: Students see me use a lot of specific vocabulary in class, and I expect them to use it when appropriate. They learn that there are differences between related mathematical objects and that this is reflected in vocabulary. When students have answered questions in writing, I have them read their written responses verbatim, and I often write those responses for all to see so that we can critique and edit them before moving on. I regularly call on students to explain their answers or the answers of peers they agree with. I place as much value on the accuracy of explanations as I do on the accuracy of the answers. Interviewer: There are three examples of right is right in this video clip. Answer the question, hold out for all the way, and use technical vocabulary. Discuss each of these moments separately. What is your point of view on how you are using each technique? Armstrong: For answer the question, the response from Mark was a pretty easy one to deflect. I think students can easily be alerted to the difference between a calculation and a definition. What I like about my response is that I did not say no, but rather just described what Mark did, and then described what I wanted. Hold out for all the way. I would try to use some ratio if I were to do this again, polling the students for other examples of cubic units rather than listing them myself. Now that I'm in my fifth year, and using a smart board, an interactive computer-assisted whiteboard, for each lesson, I can write more neatly and quickly by typing in responses. So in this case, I might type student responses on the board so that other students could both hear and see what I'm about to correct. These days, I sometimes put up several similar or contradictory answers so that students can see the differences. Use technical vocabulary. Here's a situation where I don't have a big problem with takes up. In fact, I think students need to have access to a common phrase like that while they get used to something like occupies, as long as takes up is sufficiently rigorous. This is where I like calling occupies the other word rather than the only word. Interviewer, what standards and expectations do you have for your students that lead to these three right-is-right examples? Armstrong, I love the fact that mathematics has terms like minuend, isosceles, and vinculum, because different terms indicate different functions. For example, a minuend is different from a subtrahend because they have different roles in subtraction, whereas all the terms in an addition problem are called addends because they do not differ significantly in their function. Most math words have etymologies related to their meanings, and these etymologies can help students memorize vocabulary. For example, isosceles means same legs, a helpful way for students to remember the word and later look for iso in other disciplines. Since so much of success in math depends on facility with symbols, having terms for those symbols can give students a foothold. For example, once students know what a vinculum is, they can point to a fraction or repeating decimal and talk about the vinculum instead of the bar or line or thingy. Since I have a personal expectation that I use this knowledge with accuracy, having a lower expectation for my students would feel dishonest. Interviewer, what are the most common ways that your students get off track or evade the question? Armstrong, often I call on a student who has had a hand up and get, "Oh, I have a question." My typical response is, "I need my question answered first," and I usually remember to come back to the student's question. Occasionally, students with a thorough understanding of what we're talking about will get ahead of the pace I am establishing for a topic. This is right answer, right time. The biggest difficulty is that a student who moves ahead to the end of an explanation will shift the discussion from the entire class to a one-on-one between me and him or her. To counter it, I will either tell the student that we need to make sure everyone is with us, or I might interrupt the student to restate more slowly one part of the explanation and then re-engage the entire class. Interviewer, when is right almost right and when is wrong just wrong? Armstrong, I think the just wrong case, I'm interpreting this as a time when it's appropriate to say no, is when it is clear that I am asking for specific knowledge that I expect students to recall with no difficulty, for example, a multiplication fact. Mark's response from the clip is also wrong, but that's because he understandably confused algorithm with definition. And so the appropriate response is simply to point out that confusion. Mark is not incorrect, just confused about what question to answer. I think the almost right cases are those that call for use technical vocabulary or hold out all the way, when a student doesn't use the level of rigor I want or gets close enough to the right answer that I should not throw it out. Interviewer, is there any background on students that we see in these clips that you wish to add? Armstrong, I think it's worth mentioning that those students were not at the top of their class in terms of achievement, and so I think it was important that they be treated to the same level of expectation as their more accomplished peers. Interviewer, are there any moments in these clips that you wish to draw attention to? Armstrong, watching this clip, I get self-conscious about how quickly and unintelligibly I can talk. I'm better about it now. One way to correct that habit is to say less and make the students say more, a trade-off of efficiency and speed for clarity and student participation. This example walks a fine line in terms of pacing. Defining volume was not the aim of the lesson, and this was not the first time we had done so. Therefore, I think a quick pace and my assuming a lot of the intellectual burden were appropriate. Interview with Jamie Brillante. Interviewer, describe how the concept of 100% works in your classroom and in this clip. Brillante, 100% in my classroom means that everyone is doing everything 100% of the time. I tell my students that everything we do is designed to make them great writers. I expect you to do it because I know it will make you a great writer. Everyone wants to be smarter, so everyone works hard. Interviewer, how do you balance your use of 100% with the need to maintain pacing in your class? Brillante, achieving 100% is an intentional focus at the start of the year. I use a variety of teacher tricks to get all students participating. Proximity, nonverbal gestures, wait time or countdowns, positive framing, and if necessary, deductions help students see the expectation that I have. It takes longer the first few weeks of the year. Once the precedent is set, the students know what to expect, and it does not usually affect the pacing for the remainder of the year. If there is a time where I do not have 100% in a reasonable amount of time, I tend to make the time for it because it is assigned to me as the teacher that something else is not working in the lesson. If I let it go, that student is going to think that, one, I do not see them, or two, their actions don't matter. There are moments due to student personality or in my attempt to maintain whole class engagement that I might not address someone in the moment. Usually, if I make this decision, it is because the rest of the class is unaware that someone is not with us. I don't want other students to see someone off task and think that it's okay. If I don't address it in the moment, I try to address it at some point within the lesson. I want all students to be thinking, she sees me. This helps maintain the expectation of 100% without negatively impacting pacing. Interviewer, discuss your radar and awareness of student engagement and how you are able to see what is going on at any given moment. Brillante, in order to have strong radar, I have to know my lesson. I can't look at my lesson plan and look at the students at the same time. I tend to use a combination of cold calling and high-paced questioning near the start of each lesson to create and measure student engagement. Then within the I and we portion of the lesson, I sprinkle in moments of independent work. For example, I might say, do number one and then slant. While they are working on number one, I am silently observing. If I am bent down talking to an individual student, I'm often looking at everyone else while listening to the individual student. During these sprinkles, I intentionally walk the border of the room looking at their work. The work they produce is the clue that someone might not be on task. A few moments later, when the classes come back together, my radar will be focusing in their area. Interviewer, why did you choose to make this moment a private individual correction? Brillante, although she was off task two separate times, the rest of the class was unaware of her behavior. It was more effective to make the correction privately because I only wanted to correct her. The rest of the class was working independently, so they had no idea what I was whispering to her. This allows her to avoid any unnecessary embarrassment that could have led to even more distraction on her part. I also wanted to avoid distracting the whole class from their independent work by talking aloud. I also didn't want to advertise to the whole class that someone was off task. I didn't want to plant that seed in someone else's mind. Interviewer, you give your student in this clip some very specific feedback. There are two times when you did not track the speaker. How does this specificity play into this private individual correction? Brillante, I was so specific because in the moment I did not stop the flow of the lesson to gain her sight. Yet I wanted her to know that I saw her and that it was not acceptable. She was cold-called during the lesson and answered incorrectly. I wanted her to see the connection that by not tracking, she was not learning what she needed to be successful. Interviewer, how do you keep track of the moments when you don't intervene or intervene differently? Brillante, I'm not exactly sure if I understand this question. I determine whether to make a private correction based on the student's personality, the particular moment within the lesson, and the behavior that the student is exhibiting. There are moments when I do not intervene publicly because it will affect the pacing, it will bring negative attention to a student who is seeking it, or because it can escalate a particular problem. Generally, if an individual correction can't be done in a few seconds or with a few gestures, I would prefer to make it privately. Interviewer, explain how your unaggressive approach and immediate walk away are an important part of this interaction. Brillante, my approach to this student was designed to mimic a typical conversation I would have with any student during independent work time. I didn't want it to look or feel like I was reprimanding her. I wanted it to be seen as a moment where I let her know the problem because I was concerned. I'm here to help you learn, and you did not learn in that moment. This is what I saw, and this is how you are going to fix it. I try to walk away immediately because it implies that I expect you to understand and comply with my request. It also eliminates any power struggle situation. When I walk away, it's because I know you are going to do this, and I will give you the time and space to prove it. Interview with Bob Zimmerle. Interviewer. Describe how the concept of 100% works in your classroom and in this clip. Zimmerle. 100% is crucial to achieve within your classroom, especially when you have asked for it when you use words like everybody, everyone, repeat after me, or any other nonverbal call-and-response technique. You must stop what you are doing when the students do not demonstrate 100%, or you are signaling to the students that you actually do not mean what you say, at least not all the time. It almost embeds a sense of power within the students to feel as if they are part of the lesson and part of such a strong voice going forth. It also sets students up for success, because they are expected to do the small things with all their energy, focus, and attention. It kind of carries over to the objective for the day and feeds into the rigor around the academic work. Interviewer. How do you balance 100% with the need to maintain pacing in the class? Zimmerle. Pacing is one of those things that is completely within the teacher's control. You just manipulate it like you would throttle on a motorcycle. If you feel as if the pace is dying down, you just crank it up in a variety of different ways. Expecting 100% does not need to take much time at any one given moment. You might need to expect it 30 times or more in a lesson, but each instance might require anywhere from 3 to 5 seconds. A quick statement of "show me slant" will work wonders. If you are missing someone, then "Josh, -2, please slant." The more students get used to your expectations, the less the frequency of interventions as the year progresses. Interviewer. Are you really going for 100% at any given time, or is 90% close enough in reality? Zimmerle. I am a stickler for 100%. If you accept 90%, then you are already on your way to 80% or 70%. The students also see the same things you see. If you know you are taking less, then so do they. Interviewer. Part of the 100% technique is about awareness. Discuss your own radar or awareness of student engagement and how you see everything that is going on at any moment. Zimmerle. You cannot become preoccupied with any one thing. Your eyes have to see what is happening and beyond and on either side. I believe this can be one of the most difficult things for new teachers. The more you need to have a lesson plan right in front of you, the more you get caught off guard with an unexpected question, the more you get rattled by a behavior that you were not expecting, the more difficult it is to be aware of the non-academic warning signs that are going on all around you at the same time. I play out my lesson in my head from the time I am in the shower that morning, during my ride into school, and continually until I actually am teaching it. It kind of gives you a been-there-done-that approach, even if it is your first time teaching to that objective. You have already thought of the potential pitfalls, the areas where the pacing might be a bit slower, the questions the students will have at each segment of the lesson, when you will get students up at the board, what all the other students will be doing at that point, what you will be doing when that child is up there, etc. This allows your mind not to get bogged down during the delivery of the lesson. For example, if a student has a question, 9 times out of 10, I already know what the question is going to be and how I am going to approach answering it. That way, while the question is still being asked, my mind is free to still stay engaged with the rest of the class. My eyes are rarely on the student who is asking the question. Instead, they are looking all around the rest of the room, making sure everyone else is slanting, tracking the speaker, not looking out the window, or trying to poke someone else in the back. The bottom line, the more unsure you are of your content and the lesson, the less effective your radar will always be. Your mind can't do both effectively at the same time, and usually content wins and radar loses. Interviewer. In this clip, you are describing a kind of momentum that is occurring. In one part, you point out that you don't have Marissa, but you do have Jasmine. In another, you remark that you don't have 3 people and you want them back. How does this play out in the classroom and lend itself to getting 100% engagement from your students? Zimmerle. At times, I simply tell them that I'm very jealous of their attention, and I don't want to share it with anyone. I think this lends itself to strong voice as well. From the minute you step into that classroom, you want the students to feel a shift in the atmosphere. I know it sounds hokey, but I'm completely serious here. You want them to know that you have arrived and you mean business. I don't mean in a hostile or negative way, but in my mind, a very effective teacher is a performer. Not a dog and pony show, but someone who uses the classroom as his or her stage and has an agenda that will be accomplished and a set script already in mind. It has been rehearsed many times already, leading up to the time you walk in, and there is an anxious expectation to bring it forth. They need to feel like they don't want to miss a minute of anything that happens, much like they would feel at the movie theater waiting for a movie to start. Interviewer. There seem to be several significant moments in the clip, namely the way you position yourself in front of Marissa, when you take two scholar dollars from the student in the front right, and when you bring your voice down to a whisper. Discuss how you decide what the appropriate response to any particular moment is. Zimmerly. You need to be able to play off the atmosphere you are in and constantly compare it to the atmosphere you want to be in or the one you are trying to create. Sometimes you want to make the whole class aware of a particular problem and you act accordingly. If pace is low and you still have one or two students off task or not with you, it is a much different approach. You pull out different teacher tricks like proximity, a long stare at that individual student as you are addressing the whole class, but the misbehaving student feels like there is no one in the room except you and him, since you have not taken your eyes off of him as you are continuing with what you are saying. Squaring up, leaning in on his desk, simply including his name in the sentence you are using, snapping your fingers, or simply stopping in mid-sentence. A good way to transition out of one of these moments and get back to the lesson is simply changing the inflection of your voice, as if to signal a turning of a page. If I was louder, I'll get quiet. If I was already quiet, I'll start speaking noticeably louder. Interviewer. In the clip, there are at least four of the six interventions described in the taxonomy for 100%. I see nonverbal correction, a positive group correction, a lightning-quick public correction, and then an anonymous individual correction. Describe why you choose to present these in any given moment and how effective they are. Zimmerly. Nonverbal is always for an individual and always when I need to maintain pace. Positive group is used not to lose the mojo and keep things at a more positive level. Lightning quick public correction? Again, to maintain pace, but I am beginning to see something brewing that needs to be addressed before it really gets to a much larger scale. Anonymous individual correction? I use this when I know that I don't need to specifically address the students and they will be able to self-correct within the time frame of being named, or sometimes at a possible volatile moment with a specific student where any public use of their name might actually backfire and force me into a much more severe consequence. Interview with Hillary Lewis. Interviewer. How does control the game fit into your general reading strategy and expectation? Lewis. Control the game, CTG, lends itself to guided reading instructional time and reading mastery, as it focuses directly on students reading out loud and teachers assessing students' reading behaviors. CTG allows teachers to assess student fluency and the students' decoding strategies and monitor mistakes that students make while reading aloud. CTG as a taxonomy element also requires the planning, preparation, and implementation of a strong reading culture in the classroom. Throughout the first grade classrooms, reading is a fun and special time that requires a lot of work and can be a lot of fun. Teachers' expectations during reading time are that students work hard, use the strategies, and work on learning new skills to make themselves better readers. Since everyone is working hard to become better readers, the culture of the reading group makes all readers, primary or secondary, feel comfortable with working on challenging tasks. Interviewer. Discuss how CTG works in your classroom and this clip. Lewis. In this clip, I begin the lesson by setting up my expectations for reading. All students know that their finger must be on the first word of the text in order to be ready to read. Since the scholars have no idea who I will call on to read first, all scholars want to be ready to read. Keeping the identity of the reader unpredictable truly does maximize students' incentive. All scholars were ready to read. At this time, students are reading a very short passage in their reading mastery book. Students are seated in a horseshoe format so I may easily track their reading and reading behaviors. As students read, I'm first noticing the movement of their fingers, also called tracking, to ensure that all scholars are following along with the text. At the same time, I'm listening for the reading behaviors of each student, asking myself, what words are they stuck on? What strategies are they using? Which strategies have they not yet mastered? During this clip, I keep the reader unpredictable for students, but my sequence is planned. Whenever I ask my group to read, I always begin with a stronger reader to set the pace. I will always follow a struggling reader with a stronger reader and prepare a struggling reader with a stronger reader to build leverage. By giving a struggling reader the chance to hear the text read smoothly, it allows that reader to enter into the passage with more knowledge about what the text is about and might give them some key vocabulary that will present itself in their section of the text. Interviewer: There are many nuanced moments in this clip. Explain a little more about working with your students and your use of finger follow, finger freeze. Lewis: Finger freeze is a quick verbal cue to remind scholars to stop their finger from moving in the text when they have stopped reading. This behavior has to be taught explicitly to students, as often students will lose their place while reading. When students lose their place while reading, transaction costs go up and there is more wait time. When there is more wait time, students lose engagement. When all students have their fingers frozen on the last word that was read, they can come back to the text seamlessly. Interviewer: Low transaction costs? Lewis: Again, low transaction costs keep students engaged. Since students have no idea who I will call on next, they are all ready and prepared to read. I am also checking who is ready to read by looking at their tracking in the text. If students are not in the right place, I'll silently guide them to the right word and make sure their tracking is consistent with what is being read. Interviewer: Call and response spot checks? Lewis: The call and response spot checks allow two things to happen. First, they allow students to maintain engagement with the text while I check to see who is following along. And second, call and response checks help my struggling readers with tricky vocabulary words or concepts in the text. Interviewer: How do you prepare your students for the quick transitions from reader to reader? Lewis: At the beginning of the year, I taught students to notice the end of the sentence by looking at the punctuation. Once students were comfortable with that, I asked students to read one sentence at a time, and then I would call on a new student. I explained that as readers, we need to keep our eyes on the text and be ready to read at any moment. Students knew that when they heard their name, it was time for them to pick up where the last reader left off. These transitions were not quick at first. It took weeks of practice before students could juggle tracking with their finger, listening to the reader, and comprehending what was going on in the story. But over time, I could see that scholars were truly engaged in the text, mastering tracking and listening when they would pick up the next sentence right away, eager to find out what would happen next in the story. Interviewer: How many of your readers do you decide on ahead of time, and on what basis do you choose them and the length of their read out loud? Lewis: I always keep in mind who is in need of more modeling and support and the readers who can be great models for my struggling readers. I plan in advance who I would like to open up the story, typically a strong reader, and who should follow, usually a weaker reader. Staggering the levels of readers allows the pace to stay up while maintaining accountability for all readers. Every reader gets a chance to read. For my stronger readers, they will read longer passages, while my struggling readers will read shorter sentences, more often, throughout a longer text. Interviewer: What are your most effective tools for gaining leverage among young readers? Lewis: It always starts with joy. If I'm excited to read, then students are excited to read. If I model that it's okay to make a mistake, students will be okay with making mistakes while reading. Modeling what great readers do, including what adult readers do, gives students leverage in their own reading. Within my reading group, I also build leverage by building in support when a student has a tricky time with reading. For example, in the clip, one reader made a mistake on a character's name. Without acknowledging that it was a mistake, the whole group was held accountable for saying the name out loud correctly. Jan. When the group did not say the correct name at first, I quickly asked again, and students knew to check their answer. Their response, Jan, was correct, and we were able to move on. When one student makes a mistake, all of the readers knew they could support that scholar and learn something too. For readers who are particularly shy or have serious decoding deficiencies, I would supply them with a copy of the reading passage the night before so they could practice and have exposure to the tricky words in the text. The next day, the scholars would feel more comfortable reading in front of the group and got the practice they needed. Interviewer: At the end of the clip, you announce that you are circling back around in the text to read for both expression and comprehension. How does CTG help you gain both leverage and meaning with your students? Lewis: In reading mastery, we always read the story at least two times. The first time allows scholars to work through their decoding, use their strategies, and get a sense of the text. The second time we read, after we've tackled the decoding, allows scholars to make new meaning of the text by using expression. Expression is taught as a reading skill by using clue words in the text to figure out the tone of the story. I am able to listen and see which scholars are reading with expression because they know what is going on in the text. Reading with expression adds joy to the text and keeps students engaged. Leverage goes up when students are able to interact with the text with feeling and emotion. Other scholars are more engaged and listen more attentively to the text when it's read with expression. Students are able to make meaning when the words are read with feeling. CTG allows all scholars to be part of making that meaning in the text and holds them accountable for listening to their own reading and the reading of others. Interviewer: What role does positive framing play in the use of CTG and building strong readers? Lewis: First, I always narrate the positive in reading groups, especially when students are modeling great reading behaviors, like, I love how X has her finger on the first word, which shows me students are ready to read. I use positive framing by giving students a challenge. Reading with expression means that not only do you have to decode words correctly and read with fluency, a reader must listen carefully to what's going on and use clue words to help themselves make meaning of the text. My readers know they have a lot to accomplish, they know they have a challenge, but I make it positive and exciting and encourage them by making it fun. Whenever a student makes a mistake, I use plausible anonymity. I simply say, try again, or ask the group in a non-judgmental tone to help figure out the word. I also ask students to reread, even when they've read a passage correctly, to emphasize a portion of a passage. Students get comfortable with rereading, and in my own modeling, I reread as well to show scholars that checking for errors and rereading is a reading strategy. Interviewer: What challenges do you face when it comes to CTG, particularly with young readers? Lewis: Major challenges for young readers and beginning teachers would include keeping the pace up, maintaining patience, and sustaining comprehension. When students are working hard on decoding, pacing, patience, and comprehension tend to run low. When this happens, it's important to remember that to keep pacing up, we can supply students with shorter passages and prepare them to read the night before or just before their reading session with a highlighted section of the story. When patience runs low, we must model for scholars what to do when we make a mistake or take a while to figure out a word. Have decoding strategy cue words. For example, read through to the end of the word, chunk it, what's the first sound, etc. to keep the pace up and give support as needed. Finally, if a student is stuck, employ the help of the reading team to say the tricky word to keep them engaged and also provide support for the reader. Finally, infuse comprehension questions throughout reading to ensure scholars are listening and monitoring their reading. As scholars read, give them time to go back into the text to answer questions if necessary, and encourage rereading as a way to build comprehension. Interviewer: What moments do you wish to highlight in this clip? Is there any background that you wish to add? Lewis: The reading group was the lowest performing on reading assessments. Planning comprehension questions is key. Planning who to call on is also essential. This kind of planning allowed me to see which students are comprehending the text, what comprehension skills they are using, and what types of questions my readers are having difficulty with during and after reading.
This has been a Gildan Audio production. For more affordable, life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.